Someone's fidgeting.
Thinking about the other, I was driving the other day and I was thinking about how hard we were laughing last time. I like, started like crying again.
Oh, no laughing. No laughing allowed.
It was good stuff.
Hello and welcome to Grapes and Grain Podcast. I'm Teenie.
And I'm Laura. And this podcast is about our favorite things in the world.
Alcoholic beverages.
So every season we like to do a few recurring episodes or themes. And today we're going to bust out our style highlight episode.
Woo-hoo. Yeah, you can always look forward to this. We spend an entire episode and dig down deep in to discuss the nuances of a specific beer and wine. And today the lucky contestants are porters and Cabernet Sauvignon.
Ta-da! Yeah, they both seem like really great options. They're bold styles, dark styles, cold weather, good to drink in cold weather kind of styles. So I think we did a good job of pairing it with the weather today and with each other.
Yeah,
it's a little cold and rainy today. So before we get too deep into the styles, Teenie, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
Today, I am drinking a Deschutes Black Butte Porter.
Oh, now, awesome.
It is no secret how much I love this brewery, and this is definitely one of the most recognizable porters on the market.
Yeah, I was going to say, that has some name recognition right there. I know exactly what beer that is.
Well, and now I know why. Mm. So, this was like one of the very first beers that Deschutes ever released.
Oh, okay.
The brewery was founded in 1988, so we are the same age. Yeah. That is neat. But when I went to the website, it said this is the beer that started it all. It's named for the Black Butte, which is a landmark out in the Deschutes Forest.
Gotcha.
It's a volcanic butte. But more importantly, this is the beer that solidified Deschutes' place among the tastemakers and rule breakers of the emerging beer industry back then.
That's awesome. I hope they have a t-shirt that says tastemaker and rule breaker.
We should make a shirt that says that. I wrote that.
Oh, did you? Oh, man. Oh. Then we'll put that on our Patreon page soon.
Tastemaker, rule breaker.
I love
Split
it.
Split and Swifty. Okay.
Yes. Swifty.
So this beer is also cool. So every year for the anniversary, Deschutes releases like a special barrel-aged vintage of this.
Oh, wow.
And I actually have three of them. I have 30, 29, and 28 at my house. And I want to do like a side-by-side tasting.
Oh, wow. If you do that, let's do a video for our listeners.
Yes.
That would be really cool.
I've been aging them. Obviously, my boss is actually on their beer mailing list for some reason.
Oh, wow.
But she's not a crazy adventurous beer drinker, so I always get all the Deschutes, and it makes me so happy. Oh, it's so good. But this is actually,
if
this isn't the first time I've had this beer, this is probably one of the first times that I've had this beer.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know what I'm in for. I'm excited.
Oh, wow. Even though it's one of the staples?
Yeah. I don't drink porters that often.
Mm-hmm. Well, last time we talked about the deductive tasting sheet, so give me like a 10-second or less like breakdown of what you see, smell, and taste.
Sure. And we'll get in more detail about this later.
Perfect.
When I talk about the style. But as you guys can see, this is sort of a brown ruby or a dark brown color.
Ooh, I love that description.
Yeah, it's got this nice like cream colored head. It's got good head retention.
Ooh, that is a cream colored head.
Smells like a box of chocolates.
I want to smell.
Mm. Yeah. Medium body, nice toasty,
ooh,
roasty notes. It's a really good beer.
Mm.
I'm very pleased by this, and it's kind of cold right now, so I can't wait to see where it goes.
Very cool, yeah.
All right, well, Laura, why don't you tell me what you're drinking?
What you drinking?
Well, obviously, today I'm drinking a Cabernet Sauvignon, and the one I am having is Wildberry Estates 2014 Cabernet Sauvignon, and that is from the Margaret River in West Australia.
Ooh,
yes.
I love this Australian trend every episode.
I know. I really hate, I was thinking about that. I was like, God, I'm bringing a lot of Australia stuff. I don't mean to harp on it, but it's been my experience this last year, and I really just want to share that with you and all of you guys.
I mean, you can buy California wines anytime you want. So
which is so funny because like over there they're like, yeah, whatever, Australia wines. And then in California they're like, they have ABC wines. They're like, what do you want to drink? And they're ABC, anything but California wines. But so it's funny.
That's really clever.
Yeah. But I have just been falling in love with all these wine regions around Australia that I didn't know about and I don't feel like a lot of people know about. So this one is from Margaret River. And like I mentioned, it's in West Australia. I believe it's about 3 hours south of Perth.
Okay.
Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure it's 3 hours south. So it's an area I really wanted to visit while we were living there last year. Maybe I'll get to go this next year, but I didn't. We just didn't make it out there.
It's kind of like Perth is already sort of out there, and then to go outside
girl,
of Perth.
Like it's it's like the running joke in Australia. They're like, Australia, and then there's like Perth. You know, it's just the only one on the western coast. And not to say there's other people out there in smaller towns, but as far as like the five major cities in Australia, mm-hmm. it's the one on the west.
Yep.
So we didn't make it out there, but I brought this one because it's a really great example of a bold and dark cab, like stereotypical cab. It tastes like ripe blackberries and cassis and currants. It smells like violets and graphite, like pencil shavings, and it's a little earthy. It's a full-bodied wine, but it's still pretty young. It has very young tannins and acids, and then it's still pretty juicy and fruity and with its earthiness. So it's exactly the kind of bold red wine I would want to be drinking around the fire pit on a cool evening with friends.
Yeah, it sounds like,
you know what I mean?
Sultry.
Yeah, have your, like, you know, throw blanket on with your denim jacket and your, like, hip music with your fucking fire pit and friends. And then, as it's typical for Cabernets, it's pretty high in alcohol. It's 14.5%.
Wow.
Yes. So, and to give you a comparison, like Prosecco and some of the sparkling wines I drink all the time are like 10%. So I can, you know, party on that. But 14.5%, that's high.
Yeah, it's the difference between a 5% beer and a 9.5%
yeah.
beer.
Yeah. So. It's like some of them, there's a reason one of those beers are called Sit Your Ass Down. So.
Yeah. Sit down or I'll sit you down.
Yeah, yeah. Or yeah, that's the one.
Shout out to Pinnacles.
Okay. Yeah. So... To roll right into this, I guess I'll just start.
Yeah, tell me more about it. Is that the one that you have today, is that a pretty typical Cabernet?
It is. It's pretty typical, and that's why I brought it. It's a good representation of a middle-of-the-road cab.
Okay.
So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say most of us have tasted a Cabernet Sauvignon before. Even if you're not a big wine drinker, if you've been at a big event or a party where just a faceless, mysterious glass of red wine was shoved out to guests— chances are that was a Cabernet Sauvignon.
So it's like the house blend.
It is, yeah. And it's just a kind of ubiquitous red wine. It's really widely grown, really widely drank. There's some great ones. There's some not so great ones. So chances are if you've had a red wine, you've tried a cab. And yeah, like I said, there's some really amazing ones out there. But because it is it's been consistently the top grown or the second top grown produced grape for years and years, and there's there's almost a million acres planted worldwide, like around 900,000. So,
is it like a really old grape? Is that why?
It's not that old, and I'll go into some of the history in a second. But it's not that old, but because it's so durable, and it just is so it's grown in every region, every climate,
resilient, adaptable.
It really is.
If I were a grape, I would be this grape.
Yeah. And it's arguably one of the most famous wine-produced grapes there is. So to give you a little history as we were speaking about, it's not the oldest grape variety, actually. It came around the mid-1600s.
Okay.
Which is when France and Italy, we learned in earlier episodes, really began to cultivate their wine scene and industry. It was a natural, accidental crossbreeding between two other really popular grapes, the Cabernet Franc and the Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Ta-da, Cabernet Sauvignon.
A plus B equals C.
Right. So it kind of just wildly, rumor has it, wildly started growing like a weed around French countryside until French winemakers noticed that the grape did have a very durable and thick skin, and it was pretty resistant to some of the wilder, colder, wetter weather elements in France. So they started to cultivate it on purpose, and Cabernet became kind of the poster child for the Bordeaux region of France in the 1800s. Yes. Precisely. And so Cabernet continued to gain popularity as winemakers realized the high tannins and the acids made it great for storing and aging for a long time. So you could hold on to it after you made it. It didn't spoil very quickly. And the grape juice itself responded really well to storing in oak containers because it created all kinds of new and interesting flavors in the wine.
Ooh, that like spontaneous fermentation.
Yeah, they were like, this is just like a necessity. We need to put it in these wine barrels. And they're like, hold the phone.
This is way better than how
it
went
in. Started with. Yeah. So it really helped craft the whole wine making.
Hold the raven.
Yeah, hold the raven, hold the pigeon, hold the carrier pigeon, damn it.
I've been watching a lot of Game of Thrones.
Funny. Okay, so Let's see. You put it in oak. Great for... Oh, and also to in France, this French winemakers were making it. These bolder, tannic, medium acidity wines that they were making in the, with the Cabernet grape were also really great for pairing with the super buttery and high-fat French foods. Mm-hmm. The decadence of the cooking in that time period
cut right
as well.
Through it, yeah.
Yeah, it helped. And it's not only like the acidity helps cut the fats, which kind of makes sense, but we talked about tannins in an earlier episode where we define them, but I don't think I really mentioned like the reason tannins make your mouth feel dry the way they do. And if you remember, tannins are the polyphenol compound occurring naturally in the grape skins that create the bitterness or drying effect in your mouth,
which is called astringency.
Yes. So that when they do that, the tannins are like kind of bonding with like the proteins and the fats on your tongue themselves. And that's why it makes that like...
Ooh,
drying.
Okay.
So when you, it, that's what makes these bold cabs so great for pairing with steaks and fatty foods and French fries, because the tannins bond then instead of with your tongue with the fat and the food, and it kind of cuts the richness of the fat, and the, that's what pairs so well together with them.
Yes.
Right. So anyways, that's why they were, became really popular in France, because they were like, these go super duper good together.
They make our food taste better.
Yeah. So as I started to play with the grape, they also discovered it blended really well with other varieties. And then they started creating the most famous, probably the most prolific and famous blend of wine in the world, which is a Bordeaux blend. It's mostly Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot.
Were you about to say Bordeaux?
Every time you say that, I just want to like make fun of them.
Bordeaux. It, I mean, we do make fun, but I mean, they do have some clout, some recognition. They have just been doing a really great job of making great wines for a long time.
I know, that's
but it's also
the reason we're able to poke at them.
These guys. So anyways, as the street cred and the clout of the Bordeaux brand grew globally through the 1800s and 1900s, everyone wanted a piece of that grape pie, and Cabernet Sauvignon vines were planted all over the world. Like in every country. And the popularity of Cabernet Sauvignon also accelerated again in 1976 when Napa, California's Stag Leap won the blind tasting in the competition in France.
Which was that the Judgment of Paris?
Yes. We've talked about that as well. So today it's one of the most commercially highest produced and drank wines around the world. It's got style, class, history, and quality to back up the hype. So.
Yeah. Style, class, history.
Yeah. So let's talk about what the grape actually looks like. What is it?
Yeah.
So the grape itself, when it's growing on the vine, like the fruit, has a very thick and a very dark to black skin.
Is that why it is such
exactly.
a crazy color?
Yes. So that's where the wine and the juice from the grapes itself actually get the typical color and tannins as it soaks with the skins. Another thing about to note about the vines of Cabernet is it typically buds a little later in the season than other vines and has a relatively lower yield than a lot of other vines, which makes the lower yield, the lower fruit that you have, the more intense the flavor of the grape itself. So
okay.
That's a good thing. The table grapes like you eat are high yielding vines and they're waterier and don't have as much flavor.
Gotcha.
So that's a good thing. Want it to be quite thick.
Yeah. So what does it taste like?
So, well, okay. So that's what the grape itself looks like. So the wine itself, because of the dark skins and all the tannins, the wine itself is also going to be pretty dark, full-bodied, and rich red burgundy colors. The taste. So the one that I brought is the most typical rendition of a Cabernet Sauvignon. So that's what I'm in. And with any variety or style, you can go experimental and all across the board.
Sure.
But we're going to stick it with...
By the book.
Yes. So the most typical rendition of a Cabernet Sauvignon is going to be dry. It's going to be full-bodied wine, and it's going to be high in tannins, which we mentioned were those polyphenol compounds. And it's going to have noticeable acidity, but not going to be caustically high, like maybe some of your Italians or like a Sauv Blanc or something like that. So...
But it's not, you said it's not sweet, is it?
No, it's okay. Not sweet. It's Cabernet Sauvignons are typically not sweet at all. They're going to be pretty dry.
So dry is the opposite of sweet?
Yes, yes, yeah. Okay. Dry, the opposite of dry is not wet. The opposite of dry is typically in tasting notes sweet. So sweet just means there's some sugars, residual sugars in there. And then the opposite of that statement is dry. So there's no residual sugars. It's
fermented all the way out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and like I mentioned, the tannins and the acids are what makes Cabernet Sauvignon such a great candidate for aging and cellaring wines. We mentioned that 90% of wines probably should not be aged or cellared. Drink fresh, Pinot Noirs, white wines. Mm-hmm. But Cabernet Sauvignon is definitely one you can lay down. So for taste, usually a Cabernet Sauvignon is going to smell and taste like red and black fruits, cherries, currants, blackberries. And it might have a very minerally or earthy quality to it as well, like a pencil shavings or a wet earth. And those smells and tastes come from the grape or the fruit itself. Those are called the primary flavors or scents, mm-hmm. aromas. Cabernets, we mentioned, are also usually aged in oak barrels, which will impart new flavors onto them. And those are called the secondary flavors or the bouquet.
Okay.
Oh, and, yes, I failed this pop quiz.
Yeah, aroma versus bouquet. Aroma are the primary scents and smells from the grape itself. Secondary come from the wood or the oak. And the qualities you might pick up from Cabernet that's been aged in oak is baking spices, like clove and vanilla, tobacco, smokiness, or like a leather quality, which are some of my favorite qualities in a red wine.
Sure.
So as I've been tasting, I'm learning, like, okay, I do like oaked red wines. That's a desirable characteristic for yeah. me when I'm drinking a red wine. Cooler regions that grow Cabernet Sauvignon are going to have more of a green pepper undertone, which comes from the Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh, the one of the grapes that originally...
The Mama grape. Yep.
Mama grape.
And we tasted a Sauvignon Blanc last time, which we talked about had a green pepper taste, which I think is so interesting because that's obviously where it gets it from. It's a similar molecular makeup of pyrazine. Pyrazine is a molecular compound found in green bell peppers. Sauvignon Blanc skins, and Sauvignon Blanc passed it on to Cabernet as well.
So oh, that's cool.
When people talk about tasting notes and they're like, oh, I get like bell peppers. Like they're not just
that's
making dumb stuff up. That's, you know, where that comes from. Another characteristic of Cabernets is it's typically pretty high in alcohol, over 13%. And just so you know, if you need to grab a bottle and celebrate, the Thursday before every Labor Day in August is National Cabernet Sauvignon Day.
Perfect.
Yeah. So mark your calendars.
It's basically every day in my life. But
yeah, I mean, honestly, especially in the winter.
So we're talking about this grape. Mm-hmm. What climate does it grow best in?
Oh, that's a really great question, because we mentioned that's something that applies a little bit more to the grapefruit than it does to, like, some of the beer ingredients.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I love learning about the wines with you because I'm learning about their origin.
Mm,
and beer doesn't really have that kind of origin. It has history, but it mm-hmm. doesn't have, like, origin in terms of the ingredients.
Yeah, it totally matters. And for Cabernet especially, because it is such a widely grown grape, like, where it's grown really matters about its quality, the price, the taste. So what climate does it grow best in? It grows in pretty much every wine producing region in the world. So that's kind
amazing.
Of why. Yeah, it's resilient. And that's why it's such a powerhouse. So because it's grown so much, though, it's also why it's used in bulk and mass produced wines.
Like generic blends and things like that.
Yeah, just some like BS gas station wine
France,
that's red.
Yeah.
Probably has some, cab in it, some low quality cab. And the soils that it grows best in, drainage is kind of good for Cabernet, so sandy or loamy soil. And loamy is a term that means it's an equal mix of siltiness and clay and sand. So, yeah, those are great for Cab Sauv because it drains.
Okay. You say, like, clay. Does it grow in Texas well?
Yeah, Cabernet Sauvignon is definitely one of the ones that grows in Texas. And that's funny you mention that because... Like, it's hard to say whether Cabernet Sauvignon is like, yes, let's grow it here in Texas or in any other region because it's so good and it's a perfect fit. Or are they doing it because it's so resilient and that's what people will buy
because
of the name recognition and it can grow here? Yeah. So that's definitely a question you have to ask yourself. And especially when you're, as I'm learning about the wine production industry in Texas and North Texas and all these people opening wineries and opening vineyards, is like, yeah, do you want to do Cab Sauv? Maybe Tempranillo, maybe some like Spanish or Portuguese or, you know, native grapes, maybe some Texas native grapes. But, like, are you just selling Cabernet Sauvignon because you know some, like, basic white hoes are going to come in your winery and drink it? Yeah.
Well, yeah, perception.
Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauv are two of those grapes that get planted for that
Ooh,
reason.
We
laugh, but it's they can sell it.
I'm so glad you mentioned that.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you mentioned that because that is definitely something that I personally think has been
a hindrance to the porter. So we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay. Awesome. Well, here, let me wrap up so I can hear about the porters. But so, yeah, those are the climates it grows best in. But there are certainly some areas. Sorry, I keep clapping. I'm really excited. There are certainly some areas that Cabernet Sauvignon is like, those areas are known for it. So it does grow really well in both the New World and Old World areas, which we mentioned previously in another episode. Is Old World is typically European and New World is typically Americas, South Africa, and Australia.
Basically anywhere but.
Right. Yeah, because the Old World was the only place making it, really. Before it got
anywhere
some vine
Europe.
Clippings got stuck on a ship and carted out of there. So the Old World category, Europe mostly, Bordeaux is undoubtedly the most well-known and renowned region for growing Cabernet, specifically the left bank of Bordeaux, on the right bank of the Gironde River, which splits the Bordeaux region in half. Merlot is more popularly grown, but we can go that route in another. We can go down that rabbit hole in another day. But yes, the Old World Bordeaux made it quite famous. And then in Tuscany and Italy as well, Cabernet is also grown quite a bit as a standalone grape, but really to blend a lot as well to their Sangiovese, which is their, you know, staple grape. And they use the two to create a super Tuscan wine, which is a popular, newer, bold red style.
Super Tuscan.
Super Tuscan. Yeah, you can tell just from the name. It's really going to be a powerful red.
Yeah.
And in the New World category, which, like I mentioned, is the Americas, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Napa put California on the map as a Cabernet powerhouse. And then other regions like Chile and Australia are creating some amazing cabs as well. Cabernet is one of the most widely grown grapes in Australia. So, yeah, it gets around those areas. Like, I wanted love to narrow it down, but, like, there's still quite a few areas even known for it.
So, yeah, if I were at a bar, it sounds like I could order a Cabernet and I might not get something terrible.
Yeah, I mean, it's really...
Or is that a misconception?
No, it's not. I mean, it's really such a roll of the dice. You could, and in the knowing where, who produced it, where it's from, what the price point is going to obviously help you narrow it down to get a better one. But you could order Cabernet and get a flipping fantastic wine. Or you could just get like what I got when we went to see Fleetwood Mac the other night at the stadium, which was just like a little... 5-ounce bottle of
Sutter Home
crappy, like, yeah, Woodbridge or something. You know what I mean? I was like, yeah, I'll drink it with some popcorn while I'm rocking out. No problem. But it's maybe not what I would choose to buy myself in a nice dinner.
Yeah.
So the future of Cabernet, what does it look like? It's been a major player in most regions for a long time, a very strong history. So it's not going to go anywhere soon. Obviously.
Okay.
Yeah. It's rooted itself into the wine industry. Like, it's not going anywhere. But recently, there has been a bigger move, like I mentioned when we were talking about Texas, to plant and use grapes that are more native to a specific area, like in Italy and Spain and Portugal. They're using more of their native varieties than just, like, European cab. So they're highlighting, like, what makes them so special about their stuff. So there is a trend for that. So I'm excited to see where that goes. There's also a trend for vineyards and winemakers to experiment with blending with other grapes and not depending on Cabernet so heavily as the go-to blender. So I think there is going to be less of a dependency on Cabernet Sauvignon in the future, especially in mid-range and craft wines, in my opinion. But I think those old world vines in regions like Bordeaux, those practices are not going anywhere either.
Yeah, no, yeah. That's what made them famous. So.
Right, that is like a staple of wine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At like, some point, the rest of the world just has to decide whether or not it's a fad for them.
Yeah. And then we thought we'd end each of our segments with an interesting historical fact.
You know how much we love history here on Grapes and Grain. So
I do. I just love these tidbits so
Everything
much.
Comes from somewhere.
It really does. So what I have for you is, do you remember what episode it was? Oh, it was the vocabulary episode. We were talking about decanting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I was explaining to you one of the ways you can decant is to pour off wine off the sediment on a bottle. And the reason red wine bottles are shaped the way they are is so the shoulder of the bottle will catch the sediments on the inside as
yes,
you pour it out.
I remember that my mind was blown.
Yeah. So I thought for my interesting historical fact, I would expand on that just a bit. Oh, here's a weird, interesting fact I threw in here. Cabernet Sauvignon grows on every continent but Antarctica. That's just a one-sentence statement that I thought was
Yeah, that is
prolific.
Holy shit.
Yeah. But that might be true of a lot of other wines. I'm like, I don't know. But that just sounded really epic. So, okay. So, bottles. Bottles. So the wine bottle with the shoulder that we talked about that catches the sediment, that is known as a Bordeaux bottle. They have the pronounced shoulder there. Rumor is specifically for that. Some people say it was just happy circumstances, happenstance. But
what, the design?
Yeah, it was just like that was a lucky accident. But no one really knows for sure. But a lot of people really believe that it is meant to catch the sediment.
I thought it was just for looks.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, super necessary having that shoulder if the wine is filtered or fined, as we'll learn in an upcoming episode. But it, if it's a natural wine or unfiltered wine and has sediment in it, it's definitely handy. But like I said, that is referred to as the Bordeaux style of bottle. And the other style of red wine bottle you might have seen in a Pinot Noir or a Chardonnay, where it's a longer neck and a more sloping, longer, slender.
Sure, sort of like this beer bottle.
Yeah, yeah, kind of. It's just more elegant and like a tapering than such a bold shoulder. So, and that is called the Burgundy style of bottle. So the Burgundy is the style of bottle you see in Pinot Noir and Chardonnays, like I said. They thought the shape was originally used because it was the easiest shape for the glass blowers to make. And because typically there's less sediment in the styles of like Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So there's nothing to catch. So, and then the argument is maybe Bordeaux was like, we're different and we're special and we're another special part of France. So we're going to make a different shape bottle.
We're classy. Yes. Yeah. We're innovative. We're tastemakers and rule breakers.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, and so since we're on the bottle for our interesting facts of like this weird little tidbit of French history with bottle shape and rivalry, that there's a third bottle that's widely used style as well. And that's the even longer and skinnier bottle that you see with like German wines like Rieslings and Gewürztraminer.
Uh-huh.
And historically, those were used because when you shipped wine out of Germany, it was on a raft. And you didn't have a lot of space, and you needed to pack wine in, and they needed to be skinny. And
all hold the same amount?
Yeah, yeah. They all hold 750 milliliters, but they're just, like, long and slender, and you can fit a lot of them, stack them up on a raft a little bit better. But the bottles coming out of France didn't matter because they had ports and a big old spacious wooden ship to stick them on. So, anyways, those are that's my interesting French Bordeaux Cabernet fact. Historical fact is those little three shapes of bottles that you see most commonly.
Moral of the story is, if you're planning a river or ocean vacation, consider the bottle.
Consider when you're reasoning about it. Yeah, yeah. It
when
mattered
you're
when
going to pack your wine.
It took you, you know, 18 hours on a choppy river.
To that time and I'm like, fuck no.
God, I was telling you, I was reading that novel series about like 1700 Germany, and there's a lot of river transport. I was like, the fuck?
I just terrible. Would not cross the ocean on something that, I just don't know if I would cross an ocean on a boat that wasn't like 21st century.
Depends on the situation I was living in, but I might
have. They get caught in storms in the middle of the ocean. There's
what
no
are you
saving
have
yourself.
Seven babies in industrial London. I mean, I'll take my chances on a boat.
All right. On that note, I'm going to reconsider my life choices, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. We love making this show, and we hope you enjoy listening to it, too.
That's right, and we want to give a huge shout-out to our very first Patreon donor, Jeremy.
Whoop, whoop! Jeremy was so kind to pledge at the happy hour date level, which means he gets a shout-out on air, as well as an invitation to our post-season happy hour.
If you want a shout-out on air, you can pledge as a drinking buddy, and to be invited to our end-of-season happy hour, donate at the happy hour date level. And to really knock our socks off, our top tier is Pick Your Poison, where donors can pick a topic for an upcoming episode.
Go to patreon.com/grapesandgrain to pledge your monthly contribution today.
Cheers, y'all.
Sorry, there was something.
Oh, no.
You guys are getting weird.
Computer was
reset. A hard reset.
Okay, all right.
Oh, children get older. Well, thank you so much for...
Sorry you guys missed our little Fleetwood Mac karaoke during the break.
God, yeah, Teeny took me to... I was her plus one to a Fleetwood Mac concert earlier this week, and we've been jamming Stevie Nicks so hard this week.
So, sorry about that, but that's what the random word about children getting older in the beginning was about.
Porters are getting older, too.
Porters get warmer.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so... Thank you for listening to my epic tale about Cabernet Sauvignon.
You're welcome.
I truly appreciate your rapt attention.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
Yeah. That's why they pay me in porters. So I'm really excited to support you in the same way and learn
Are
about
Are you going to supporter
this.
Me?
Yeah.
Are you my supporter?
I'm one of your biggest supporters.
Oh, my God. Just
okay. So okay,
we're ready.
Tell me about porters. I'm excited.
I'm glad you're excited because the porter is a really fun creature and a staple. It has been a staple of drinking all the way back to the 1700s. Ooh. It was one of like the original beer styles. But the story of the porter is really interesting because it follows the evolution of the kiln.
Okay.
And just for a refresh, a kiln is the equipment that is used to dry malt.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you can heat it to varying degrees and you can turn it into varying colors. Porters are distinguished by their dark brown or black color and this pleasant, roasty chocolate flavor.
Well, so, that's kind of interesting. Like, that it's parallel to the evolution of the kiln, because that's kind of parallel as well to the evolution of like humans being able to control fire and heat and the industrial revolution.
Absolutely.
And wielding these energies. So that's kind of cool. It's just alongside with like the history of human culture. It's just chugged along.
Absolutely. So the chocolatey flavors that I was mentioning, those come directly from the malts. But back in the 1700s, the most technologically savvy way to kiln malt was by exposing it to direct fire.
Oh, just like tossing the grains like in your campfire type
of
thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Situation.
It made it really difficult to control the way that the color or flavor would turn out.
Tin foil to like package it up for anything.
Right. So really pale malts and really dark malts weren't really a thing. Mm. Most of the malt was amber brown and also added this smoky, toasted characteristic to the malt.
Ooh, I bet it was pretty smoky.
So porter was considered basically a brown beer that was maybe aged a little bit. And there are also theories, actually, that back in this day that porters might have had a wild or sour flavor characteristic since it was aged in wooden vats for long periods of time.
Huh.
And so it might
like
have absorbed like some extra bacteria from the wood.
Right. Yeah, it could be like the wood barrel sometimes if they suck up an unsavory flavor that's just kind of in the wood. Yeah.
So we'll never really know. The porter is like a story of like evolution and anamorphosis.
Yeah.
But that is until 1816. There was this guy, his name was Daniel Wheeler, and he patented what's called a drum roaster. And this was a great innovation because basically it was a metal cylinder that physically separated the malt from the fire, gave it indirect heat, and that completely revolutionized the porter.
Oh, wow. Is that kind of what they use for roasting coffee beans as well? That kind of drum roaster?
This was the first time anybody had like roasted malts.
Wow, cool. Okay.
And so you could actually make a black malt. And it wouldn't have any of the smoky characteristics either because it's not touching the flame.
Huh.
So up until this point, brewers had also kind of been cheating with the color in beer.
Mm.
Instead of using roasted malts, like I guess the black malts, which were not only more expensive, but because they were burnt, they had a lower fermentable sugar count.
Of course.
Which use more of them. So it was really expensive. So a lot of brewers were using caramelized sugar to give the pale malts the brown color for a porter.
What did we call that when we had Robert Licorice in? It's not the dosage.
I can't remember.
Oh, my gosh. It'll come to me. I'll look it up on our break.
Okay. So when his invention, the drum roaster, comes along, completely innovative to the style of beer, but it was also pretty controversial.
Why? What was the controversy?
Well, the porter was considered the drink of the working man. And I have this book. It's called the Oxford Companion to Beer. You know, it cites a legend where there was actually a specific English tavern where these men who carried goods and fish and things to the
porters.
To the ports. They would come to this English tavern, and that was like
that's why
the
they
story
named
of the beer.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So it was named after the people.
I was going to say, when you say working
kind
class,
of legend.
You mean like English working class.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
This is the 1800s, remember?
Porters. Yeah. That's cute.
Okay. And it was predominantly cask conditioned beer because of the lack of refrigeration around then.
Uh-huh.
So when Wheeler comes in and sort of like moves their cheese, changes their beer, they're like kind of pissed off about it. And they're like, oh, you can't get real porter
anymore.
Yeah. Ugh. Well, because it was different. Also, traditionally back then, the porter was actually a blend of different beers that they had because the malt was so inconsistent that they were so different that they had to blend them together to get something that their people wanted to drink.
Yeah.
So he comes and he innovates, and they're just sort of pissed off about it. But anyway, that's
people are reluctant to change. It's just human nature. It's tails all the time.
So as malt roasting technology is refined, black malt starts to be used in different ways. And the stout, okay, so a lot of people get stouts and porters confused or maybe don't know the difference.
I would be in the don't know the difference camp, I think.
And I was for a long time also. So back when the porter was a thing, the stout was also a thing. Okay. The porter is sort of this liquid definition. It's any dark beer that's sort of been aged, right?
Okay,
okay. And in fact, my book cites that dark beer was stout first, then was called porter, and then there was another reference to a beer called stout porter as its own thing. So they're very intertwined.
Yeah.
All that to say that as new technologies was developed, these styles became more defined and blossomed into their own specific things, but over a period of like centuries.
Right.
So by the
evolution of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So by the early 20th century, however, the style was becoming like a shadow of its former self.
Oh, no.
It was like sort of watery, thin.
Late 20th century.
Yeah. So like beginning in the 1900s. And then by 1950, it was basically obsolete. No one was buying it. No one was making it. Nothing.
Okay.
So that's sort of like a really sad history, but also...
Has it made a resurgence? Has it made a hipster resurgence? Please tell me hipsters have brought it back.
A little bit.
Can I say, the reason I know about porters is because of a home brewing, the Dallas Home Brewing Club I was actually a founding member of back when I used to, so long ago.
Where's your pin for that?
Right? Yeah. And one of the other founding members, we would do homebrew nights once a month and tasting, and he did a s'mores porter, and he called it a smorter.
I like that.
And he put a ton of like lactose in it and like graham flour and like all this other stuff. And it was delicious, but it sounds like it would make me die nowadays.
Yeah, actually, that's interesting because that sounds... let me tell you a little bit about what porter
is. Please do. Please
because
do.
That to me doesn't sound like... I mean, I guess it could be a porter at its quarter.
It's not at its...
But traditional porters are not like that at all. So, yeah, they're usually brown or a ruby brown or dark brown in color.
Ruby brown. I love that description of that color.
Yeah, look, when you put it up to the light, it sort of gives this, like, reddish hue.
Yeah.
You see? It's not totally opaque. You can see through the beer. The clarity is there.
It's dark. But, yeah, you can totally see through it.
Yeah. And it's... definitely a malt forward style. This whole history of this has come from the malt and its characters. So you're not going to get...
Malts are not subtle.
I mean, there's hops in there, but no evident hop character.
Yeah.
And on the nose, you're also going to get that. It's going to be flavors like cappuccino, cocoa, some chocolate. Really, it's supposed to have a creamy mouthfeel, but a medium body. So like, it's not going to be super heavy or weigh you down. And it's actually not a very sweet style either.
Great. This is so much like a cab. We did such a good job pairing these.
Yeah. The aftertaste, in my opinion, it actually dries out pretty quickly, leaving some nice, like, soft, even a little bit of bitter notes.
Ooh. Okay.
Now, stout, on the other hand.
Yeah. What's the difference there?
Yeah. A stout, compared to a porter, is going to be a little bit bigger and a little bit bolder.
Okay.
The stout will also be more viscous, so thicker.
Ooh, yeah, I was going to say, let's explain what that is. Yeah.
Probably sweeter, but stouts also run the gamut from like a super dry Irish stout to a super sweet stout. So like that has a huge spectrum.
But it's like more of like a motor oil, thick, syrupy texture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stout. Yeah, now I guess that makes stout. It's a stout beer.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because stout is also now like an adjective. So
yeah,
there's also a substyle called the Baltic Porter.
Ooh, I've never heard of that.
These harken back to when England was shipping beer to Russia.
Okay,
sort of around the imperial time, which is also sort of where the word imperial is traced back to.
Yeah.
So, unsurprisingly, these will be bigger, boozier. Bigger body, creamy mouthfeel.
Yeah.
Darker. Just like taking the porter to a little bit, like leveling up.
Ooh, bolder, boozier. I like it.
Yeah. So the...
Yeah. What are... So England,
let
you
me
said...
Let me wet my whistle.
Please do. So England's pretty known for this. Are there?
Yeah, in
is
fact,
this like an area specific style, or what's who's known for making the best porters?
This is definitely an English thing.
Okay,
definitely an English thing. Roots in the English and London, and it was wildly popular back when the country was colonizing the U.S. as well. So once like things sort of fell apart between the U.S. and Britain, it was up to American breweries to sort of fill that demand for porter.
Once things fell apart. That's such like a mild way of putting like we. Fucking revolted.
Get off of. They didn't call it the Porter Party, but now that looking back, they probably should have. That alliteration is wonderful.
Way better, yeah.
So, but the Oxford Companion to Beer says that Porter's heyday was actually like 1820 when everyone in London was drinking it. And surprisingly, it's just not that popular of a style these days. You know,
I went to... You know, with crafty people, I think it is, but not maybe with the common man. The
let
common
me tell
drinker.
You, when I went to Total Wine to pick out a porter for this show, they have a giant section of single bottles, and they're arranged by style.
I'm so jealous.
You're just like, so dramatic. I was like, I haven't even gotten to the dramatic part yet.
I was shopping in the aisle the other day, and that was my reaction.
So they're arranged by style, and porters are literally only one shelf. It was one shelf. Part of the shelf was taken up by a giant box full of ping pong balls. I took a picture. There were literally only like 7 options of
Total
single
wine.
Pick out porters.
What the heck? Total Wine.
I mean, it's Porter really, Porter. I think compared to the stout too. So let me talk about a couple famous ones,
please
I guess.
Do.
So
please
Breckenridge
do.
Brewing's Vanilla Porter is really renowned, and they were like one of the first craft beers to like make that style popular.
Mm-hmm.
Owned by one of the big companies now. And then obviously Deschutes is one of the go-to styles. Anecdotally, again, I see stouts more often, and I think there might be a little bit of a stigma and perception problem. A lot of people who I
PR
meet
problem.
Who are just getting into beer say they don't like dark beer, and that's just a false statement because dark beer does not mean one thing. Back when porter was not defined, dark beer, that's what that meant. But now the range and the versatility of flavor, it's not enough to say, I don't like dark beer. Well, what don't you like? Do you not like the sweet quality? Is it the bitter quality? A lot of people just assume dark beers are heavy, and porter is one of those really interesting styles that it's not a heavy beer.
Yeah.
In fact, it's suggested that you drink it year round because it's not going to weigh you down. It just has these really robust characteristics. So I think maybe a lot of breweries are offering either porter or stout just to avoid that kind of confusion.
Huh. Boldly embrace both, guys.
Yeah, right?
And also make gluten-free versions while you're at it. Thanks. Bye.
So is it time for my historical anecdote?
Yeah, please. Lay it on me. My favorite bit. My favorite country bit.
Okay, so... Remember when I said the earliest versions of this style were suspected to have possibly been wildly fermented and possibly funky and sour?
Yes. How could I forget the funk?
Because they were being aged in those oak vats and the bacteria is being imparted on them.
Yep.
So the guy who coined the term Brettanomyces, which is a wild yeast that offers a funky characteristic to beer, he was a Danish brewery owner named N. Higelte Clausen?
Clausen for sure. Higelte?
Yeah, you got it. Nailed it.
Yeah. Nailed it.
That was a pity nailed it, but that's okay.
That was a free pass, nailed it.
So he originally found Brettanomyces. He coined the term, and he originally found it in England.
Yeah, because I guess they had the oldest, funkiest barrels, to be
fair. I guess so. So apparently the translation is literally the British yeast.
Brettana. Yeah, okay.
And in 1904, he brings this yeast to a meeting at the Institute of Brewing.
What did he bring it to? Like, just here's a little mason
Petri
jar full of...
I don't know, Or he brings his research. He brings something.
Yeah.
And he's like, dude.
The baggie of yeast.
He's like telling them. He's like, this is what I'm calling Brettanomyces because it gives beer an English flavor. Like, that was the flavor of English beer.
This is the English funk. This is the English stank on the beer that we can't quite capture. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, eventually as technology progressed, that bacteria was broken down into subcategories and strains and all of that. Britain is not known for their wild or sour beers, which is what makes this anecdote
you know, pretty curious.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Really ties it in.
Well, I guess to wrap up, let's decide, as a final verdict on both of these styles, did we like it? Did we love it? Did we like it?
I really like porters. In learning about porters, I was inspired because I just brewed a porter.
Yeah, yeah.
And
totally.
I sort of love that.
I helped you bottle it. That was neat.
And I just sort of love that it was this, like, undetermined, sort of fluid, you-do-you type of style for a long time. And I definitely think that there are misconceptions about it. So if you're hearing this episode, don't consider it a heavy beer or a thick beer. Mm. Give it a try.
Yeah.
What about you? Cab?
I love it. Okay, so I'll be honest. It took me a while to come around to cabs and pretty much red wine in general as I started tasting more. You know, I started my journey with whites a lot. They were just easier for me to tell the differences between the nuances. And honestly, I think I just had way too many crappy stadium or gas station Cabernets. Like, you know, just icky stuff.
Applebee's are like my mom and I used to go to Bennigan's to get
Bennigan's
like house
Cabernet.
Wine.
I can't not, won't.
She,
not,
I mean,
don't.
She would get the Merlot, but I would get the house.
Stop. Oh, God, it's so bad. So I've had a lot of bad ones. So I did not like them at first, just on my connotation with them. But I can honestly say there is nothing like an amazing Cabernet, especially, you know, one of these Australians or Napa or French Cabernets, especially with a great dinner with family or sitting around the fire with friends. And I'm a little sentimental about Cabernet Sauvignon now as well, because the very first bottle that I put in my cellar to start collecting wine, which I have a little bit of a collection now, was a Napa Tate Cabernet Sauvignon. So,
Yeah, that's special.
Yeah, it's a little special to me. So,
have
I'm gonna
you tried that beer yet?
Wine. And
oh, sorry. Yeah. I was thinking cellar. Yeah. In my brain. Sorry.
So,
does not compute.
So, yeah, every wine story I tell, you just imagine me with a beer in my hand. But no, I've tasted some of their Cabernet Sauvignon, but I actually won this bottle of wine in a sales competition in the wine bar that I was working in, and I won the reserve bottle. Yeah. So,
I meant, have you tried it yet?
I've tried the standard one, but not this reserve
so
kind.
You still have that bottle?
Oh, yeah, it's still in the cellar.
Ooh. That was my whole question all along. Sorry, you guys.
Sorry. Sorry, I misunderstood. But yeah, so that's it. That's all I got about Cabernet Sauvignon. And I've loved learning about porter.
Yeah.
Well, sweet.
I'll raise a glass to that.
Hell yeah. Cheers, girl.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured on our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Grapes and Grain Podcast. Remember, that's grapes plural and grain singular.
Find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.com to see blog posts that go more in depth to each episode. You can also download or stream the podcast there.
And of course, find us on Patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. And a huge thank you to Jack and Dorothy Studios for having us in today. We couldn't do it without you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today. Cheers.
Cheers.
What you drinking?